This month's podcast features Michael Horn, author, speaker, and distinguished fellow at the Clayton Christensen Institute, discussing blended learning and the future of education. Michael is the author and co-author of multiple books, white papers, and articles on education, including the award-winning classic, Disrupting Class, How Disruptive Innovation Will Change the Way the World Learns, with Clayton Christensen, and the Amazon bestseller, Blended, Using Disruptive Innovation to Improve Schools. In this podcast, you'll hear how Michael first arrived at the definition of blended learning.
You know, the things you did online and the things you did offline had to be connected in some way. And the big idea there was simply, you know, when I was in grade school and occasionally I'd get kicked out and say, you know, go do some Oregon Trail. And great part of school to do 20, 30 minutes of Oregon Trail, but it had nothing to do with the social studies or science or English or math lessons that I was doing. And so they had to be connected in a meaningful way with the online and offline modalities. So that's where we ended up.
How the use of technology in the world of education advanced during the pandemic.
Without technology, like, yes, there's been a lot of devastation and learning loss out of the closures and so forth. But without technology, what would we have had? Like, if this had happened 20 years ago, you know, as disastrous as it's been for kids, and it's not been good, it would have been 10 times, right, what it's been. And I think we don't step back and like marvel at how amazing it is that we've had some of these tools at our disposal to keep some continuity of learning and connection going for students, parents, teachers and schools in some pretty neat ways.
And how important blended technology can be for individual learning when used in a model based on mastery.
How do we help be the best, every individual be the best unique version of themselves, as opposed to trying to compete to be the best on some very structured linear ladder that breaks apart the moment we get into the real world anyway, and we start to realize, oh, those rankings and things that I thought were so important, no one actually cares in the way that I thought they did, right? The prestige that I thought was so important, you know, maybe it pales in comparison to, you know, are my daughters happy today, right? And things of that nature.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of online learning, resources, training, and support. JFY's individualized, self-paced curricula help raise individual and school performance by maintaining grade-level skills and combating learning loss. JFY provides online curricula aligned to state and college standards from grade 5 through high school, with personal support online and via phone and email from friendly learning specialists like yours truly. JFY also supports early college and dual enrollment high school programs, providing supplemental online instruction and resources to help ensure student success and matriculation into post-secondary education. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. Michael Horn has been studying and writing about the realm of education for most of his life. He was named by Tech and Learning magazine one of the most important people in the creation and advancement of the use of technology in education. He is currently a senior strategist at Guild Education, which partners with leading employers and organizations to help offer education and upskilling opportunities to America's workforce. He is also the co-founder of and a distinguished fellow at the Clayton Christensen Institute for Disruptive Innovation, a nonprofit think tank that advances the seminal work of its legendary namesake. His website, michaelbhorn.com, contains a wealth of information about competency-based learning, blended learning, and other related educational topics. A recent conversation with JFY Executive Director Gary Kaplan began with how Michael first became involved with educational technology.
Okay, well, Michael, I'm very glad to have the opportunity to have this conversation with you about blended learning and all the many connections that term brings up. Before we push on into talking about blended learning, I would like to just get some background about how you got into this business. I mean, I'm sure that, you know, your parents envisioned something much more stable than this for you. How did you wander off the path and get into this briar patch of education and technology?
It's a great question, Gary. Where did it all go wrong? And devote to impact rather than dollars, right? But the exactly. You know, it's really fortuitous set of events. I had a public policy and writing background, as you sort of implied. I went to business school to try to get away from those things, and I was unsuccessful. I took Clay Christensen's class while I was there. You know, right? So he's for those that don't know, you know, Clay was an amazing teacher, and his ideas of innovation are incredibly powerful and transformed literally how I saw the entire world. And he had this opportunity to co-author a book with him, applying it to public schools. And I thought, well, gosh, like, this is sort of my background, but with a set of ideas and a person I really believe in. I think I'm crazy to take it. I'd be crazy not to take it. And I took it. You know, Clay's deal was, well, we'll write the book in 1 year and then you'll go out and do whatever it is you actually want to do. Book Disrupting Class took 2 years to write. We founded the Clayton Christensen Institute together. And by the end of the process, I really believed in these ideas. And so, you know, that sort of leads one thing to another, where every morning you all of a sudden you're waking up and you're like, okay, how do we better create a world in which all individuals can build passions and fulfill potential? And the current education system isn't that.
Let me just comment on that. You know, I knew him slightly. You know, I met him a few times, had a great interview with him in his office. And he was just such a compelling guy, totally mission driven. And everything, yes. You know, the book that he wrote, later in his career about, you know, what values have you lived?
Yeah,
by?
How will you measure your life? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, who else in a business school talked like that? You know, you after spending an hour with Clayton, you know, your whole point of view was totally changed.
Yeah, and he did it by asking questions and telling stories often unrelated to the question you asked, but giving you a prism through which you could say, oh, I hadn't thought about the parallels of X, Y, or Z, right? And then you'd make the leap yourself. And as Clay always said, you know, look, if Gary's going to come into my office, he knows way more about education than I ever will. But if I can tell him, you know, just about how this theory applies in this particular circumstance that's connected, I bet he's going to figure out way more stuff than I ever would, and make it run. And so it was your idea by the end, right? And so it's something I think I'm still struggling to learn from as I work with others about how to use that thinking to help others, you know, create ideas as opposed to, oh, I know the answers, which, you know, is sort of this arrogance that isn't true.
His humility was just amazing. And, you know, as prominent and famous and all of that as he got, he was always just a very humble guy. Yeah. And as you say, you know, well, you know more about this than I do, so let me hear what you have to say. Amazing. Yeah. Amazing.
No, it was incredible human.
Absolutely. So that's how you got into this, was through the business school and through Clay. The definition back years ago, you know, when we were all back, like in the early decade, was that the early 2000s, there were all kinds of different terminology floating around. And I remember quite a bit of the writing that you did and some other folks there too, was just trying to get a definition of what is this. Could you just talk a bit about the evolution of the definition and how we got to, okay, let's call it blended learning. And can we just put a period after that and stop arguing about what we're going to call?
Stop arguing about it.
Yeah. How did all that happen?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll take a step back, actually, just because you know, where you started your question, I think, is interesting. Because when we even wrote Disrupting Class, we really struggled with what is the phenomenon that is growing. And in the first version, I think we called it computer-based learning. And in the second version, I think we called it online learning. Like, we were really not sure how to describe it ourselves, and went through several permutations, both in the drafts with peer folks, you know, giving us feedback. And then even in the different versions, it's If I'm not mistaken, the 2008 version is totally different from the 2010 version. And then in 2010, as you noted, people got even more heated about, well, my school's blended learning and yours isn't, or my classroom is and yours isn't, and mine's flipped, which makes it this. And it, you know, we basically thought we're wasting a lot of energy on this. Clearly, these are all different forms of blended learning. Clearly, not all blended learning is good, right? Just like chemistry can be used for good, it can be used for evil. Blended learning can be used for good and bad as well, I'm sure. And so we basically just went out to all these people. So it was hundreds of folks that people said, they're doing blended learning. That's what I would consider blended learning. And we looked at the common denominators and we said, you know, what is it? And so that, you know, basically over, it was really, Gary, a three-year process of putting out white papers with a definition. And then, you know, people like yourself or others would come back to us and say, ah, you missed a thing. Like, this is clearly in, right? And so we would go back and change a word here or there. But we ultimately came up with this idea that three parts of the definition, it's online learning. Students got to have some control of the time, place, path, or pace of the learning. I think that remains an important part because we weren't just putting, you know, film strips on in lecture classes, right? And saying that was somehow blended learning. The second is it had to take place at least in part in a school with a teacher around. And I think that was important because a lot of the full-time virtual schools, they have significant offline components to their curriculum, right? Like the younger kindergartners, first graders, second graders, they're not just learning online the entire time. They've got manipulatives and books and things of that nature. So the place was important for K-12 learning, different for higher education, incidentally. And then third, you know, the things you did online and the things you did offline had to be connected in some way. And the big idea there was simply, you know, when I was in grade school and occasionally I'd get kicked out and say, you know, go do some Oregon Trail. And great part of school to do 20, 30 minutes of Oregon Trail, but it had nothing to do with the social studies or science or English or math lessons that I was doing. And so they had to be connected in a meaningful way with the online and offline modalities. So that's where we ended up. And then we basically said, now let's start studying all the different permutations and what sort of makes it effective and what not. And, you know, it's the same problem, right? With there's all these academic research out there around, is technology good or bad for education? And it's like, well, clearly it could be used either way. What about it makes it good is the interesting question to be probing and asking. And so I think the definition that we put out there for blended learning helped just create a floor, if you will. And it was a rare time, by the way, where there wasn't millions of media outlets and stuff like that. And so people were able to have a conversation, I think, and largely accept that definition. And then, to your point, move on and ask what I think are the more important questions.
I think the review that you just did of Andre Waters' book, interesting that we're still having that argument. Or at least some people are still having that argument, but I think a lot of people still do feel like technology is a threat to freedom, mm-hmm. and that it's a Skinner, you know, a Skinner type of thing. Put the kid in a box and you know, give him pellets when he hits the right lever. But Clayton, you know, I mean the definition that you guys came up with in Disrupting Class, all the processes by which an organization transforms inputs of labor, capital, materials, and information into products and services. A teacher teaching in front of a class is a technology. Students taking notes are a technology. Computers are a technology.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's, and of course, it goes back to the Greek, of course, but what, we're against technology? Really?
Yeah,
so
no, I think it's such an important point, right? And you know, that's the other piece when in Audre Waters' book, I'm blanking on the title right now, but, you know, theoretically a history of personalized learning or something like that. There's no Montessori. Well, clearly the manipulatives in Montessori are a technology that are ingenious toward personalizing for what the individual child needs at any given point, or, you know, what helps them make progress. And to your point, a lot of choices built into those Montessori systems that directly contradicts a lot of what you said. Tutoring, right, is a technology based on that. And that's the ultimate in personalizing. And you know, the challenge with tutoring is it's just not scalable, it turns out. So I think the really interesting thing of digital technology is how do we start to scale some of those things so everyone can have these tutor-like experiences, not to restrict, but actually to create, you know, more opportunities for people to discover and build passions and go deep in certain things and so forth.
Well, the other statement that I really liked out of the book was the primary problem of education is the conflict between the diversity of learning styles of students and the operational need of large organizations to standardize their processes. Customization versus standardization. And he saw you guys saw computerized instruction as the technology that could reconcile those opposing needs. And you talked about it back then as student-centric technology, mm-hmm. student-centric. And, you know, when you jump ahead a couple of decades now, and I mean, I don't know if you know any 3 or 4 year olds, but, or even 2 year olds, you know, they're on this, you know, in whatever device they have, they're doing all kinds of things. And you can't, you know, you watch a 4 year old do whatever the heck it is they're doing. You can't argue that is impinging on the kid's freedom. No, they're doing all kinds of stuff. You know, they're saving the world. So the antinomy between technology and freedom is completely ridiculous.
Yeah, I think it's a bizarre conclusion to your point. And I guess I'd also say, like, this Skinner notion, right, of we're going to have the perfect artificial intelligence algorithm that's going to predict every single thing and control you in this behaviorist ideal. It's simply not going to work. There's no evidence like for every single thing one would learn that it would work. And a big part of that is because students aren't going to stay engaged, right? They want to explore. They want to have that bizarre light bulb moment that only goes off in their heads and not the other 29 kids in the class. And then they want to ask a question and dive deep on that, right? And technology allows for you to do that and have that freedom, incidentally, to do that. But like the super restrictive view, it's not going to work because kids, like those explorations, those magic light bulb moments, the opportunities to be social in your learning, for the vast majority of kids, I'm not going to claim everyone wants a social learning experience, but the vast majority, 90%+ do. And if you think you can somehow control it in this over technology dystopia, it's not going to work. So I think it's a fear that is not, to your point, it's a bizarre fear in my mind because, you know, I look at my kids and I've got 7-year-old twins, so they're not 4, but you know, they were recently. And look, I don't want them on the screens on the time, you know, balance is important, but they grab my phone, they text grandma, you know, they know way more about the emojis and how to change up the setup at all sorts of things than I do, frankly. And it's allowing them to develop their voice and communicate. And by the way, it's reinforcing their literacy and things that they're learning. It's pretty neat to see what they can do with it.
But also, since the development of social media, which was not around back when we were first trying to figure out what to call this, I think it's become clear that technology, it does not restrict social contact. It actually accelerates it. It's a medium of social contact, not a medium that works against social contact. So I think that whole idea that people are going to be trapped on a screen and are never going to talk to anybody again, it's just proven to be
I think wrong. It flies in the face of what we know about people, you know, and we concluded this again in the revised version that we put out of Disrupting Class, that a core job to be done that students have on a daily basis is to have fun with their friends. And if you create a solution or a schooling environment in which they cannot do that, you're going to create friction. It's not going to work. And I frankly think that's why a lot of the whole class, you know, methodologies that we have that dominate so much of schooling don't work, because they punish kids when they try to have fun with friends. That's, you know, disrupting class when I was in school was a bad thing. You know, me pencil fighting in the back row was counterproductive. How would you use that social energy positively? I think it's a really important question. And to your point about social networks, obviously, you know, this is a very politically fraught topic right now of whether they're good or ill. But my take is very similar to Ben Thompson's on this, the writer of Strategery, which is just simply, you know, they amplify the good and bad of humankind, right? And we are social beings, and you put us in a social environment, there's a lot of good that comes out of that. And there's a lot of bad that comes out of that. And, you know, it sort of is what it is, but it's not restricting anything. It's actually increasing the velocity of those interactions.
To a point where, channeling them or trying to control them becomes a huge problem.
Yeah.
So let's kind of move into the question of how technology, computer technology, but which also includes cell phones and all the other personal devices. And soon, of course, is going to include Mark Zuckerberg's
metaverse. That's another Oculus, whole thing.
Let's not even go there today.
Okay.
That's too frightening. How do you see it being technology in this broader sense? How do you see it being used now around the country? You know, however much you're aware of, how do you see it being used now? And where do you see it going in the next? I mean, actually, the way that things change now, we should probably be saying, how do you see it going in the next 30 minutes? But in the next few years, where do you see it going?
Yeah. So, look, obviously, it's a truism at this point that COVID accelerated the adoption of technology right in our schools. I think the more remarkable statement is the inverse of that in some way, which is that without technology, like, yes, there's been a lot of devastation and learning loss out of the closures and so forth. But without technology, what would we have had? Like, if this had happened 20 years ago, you know, as disastrous as it's been for kids, and it's not been good, it would have been 10 times, right, what it's been. And I think we don't step back and like marvel at how amazing it is that we've had some of these tools at our disposal to keep some continuity of learning and connection going for students, parents, teachers and schools in some pretty neat ways. Now, do I wish people were doing things more? Yeah, I think a lot of times they took technology like Zoom that we're recording on and just put their whole class teaching style online, and it didn't work before and it wasn't working online either, right? Because now your classroom management techniques you had learned, it turns out, are less effective when the person could just hit off on the video, right? But, you know, a lot of teachers, I think, and schools saw that there are very engaging programs out there that can personalize learning, right? And so a lot of those sorts of things started to increase in adoption. And I think, you know, parents got brought into the loop in a way that was never before true, where they got to see up close the good and bad of what was occurring a lot of times in the schooling environments. And I think the ripple effect of that, we're still not completely sure, but I do think it's going to be hard to roll back completely a lot of that connectivity and use of digital technology and opportunities for unstructured learning that started to occur for large sets of students. I think the second thing that we'll see is, you know, where you started, which is the personal devices, the phones that so many kids have. I really think that's the next wave of the disruption right now that is not talked about nearly enough in technology, which is, you know, if it was computer-based or CD-ROM, right, to online learning, mobile learning is sort of that next wave, I think. And I'm incredibly optimistic about the potential there. Maybe not as much on the creator side of it quite yet, but in terms of the learning side, it seems to me that the limitations of the phone in terms of bandwidth and video and things of that are actually benefits for learning, because they create a more active learning experience. You look at like Duolingo for language learning, or some of the things that Imagine Worldwide, a nonprofit, is helping facilitate with $1 billion in KitKat learning in countries, in developed countries, where kids literally have no access to school whatsoever, places like Malawi and things like that, where they're incredibly interactive, right? And so kids are constantly touching, and every 6 seconds they're making an action as they learn, which we know active learning is incredibly important for driving real learning, because, you know, learning is not a passive process. It requires someone to sit forward and do things and make sense of the information and construct meaning out of it. And so I'm really excited about some of these new mobile learning applications come out. I think they'll get spread very unevenly in many cases, but, you know, I think they're tremendously exciting. And then I'll contradict myself a little bit and say, the other thing I think that they're doing is, I talk to a lot of, you know, professionals who say, my kids already personalized their learning outside of school with YouTube, right? Like whenever they don't understand anything, they just find a YouTube video and they figure it out. And I think that unconstrained access to content and solutions can really help fuel people's curiosity toward positive ends. And so a lot of the informal stuff that's going on with devices, I think is tremendously exciting, and something that I think will accelerate in the years ahead.
That's really, really an interesting line of inquiry. That kind of the four characteristics that, you know, that have been agreed upon for a long time: time, place, and pace are fairly obvious. All right, I think there's not too much to argue about there. Path, however, is an interesting concept. So that seems to conflict with the idea of standards. You know, we have grade level standards, we have MCAS, we have all this stuff that all came out of No Child Left Behind. But kid is, you know, by the end of ninth grade, 10th grade, 11th grade, a student is supposed to have learned certain things, which are all codified in the state curriculum standards. Now, if we start giving kids autonomy in terms of path, does that mean that a kid is free to go down some rabbit hole and, you know, learn about Android, you know, Androids and electric sheep, and not complete the 10th grade standards, and therefore do badly on the MCAS and get his school a bad rating and get all the teachers fired? How does path work in a standards-based environment?
Yeah, I love the question. And I think we need to decouple some of the concepts, right? So one of them is, I think learning standards are not a bad thing, but when they're coupled with time, that's when they become a bad thing, if that makes sense. So being able to say Michael has or has not yet mastered two-digit addition, that's an important standard, right? But perhaps we should stop thinking of it as tied to the second grade standard or wherever it appears, and more, you know, is Michael continuing to make progress, checking off different standards, right? And by the way, we could have more standards that gave a more holistic picture of who Michael is throughout his learning. And then the second thing I think is we need to have a more deliberate, I think, from a public education perspective, a more deliberate conversation about what really is core, if that makes sense. And what do we think, you know, does someone really, really need by the time they get to high school, or and where can we allow that flourishing and individuality, right? And where do we think something's unproductive? You know, I like to joke there's a limit, I think, to the freedom over path and choice of, you know, the kid that wants to do underwater basket weaving for an entire year. I do want a teacher beside them saying, I'm going to push you a little bit, right? And I probably do want some guidelines, but, you know, constrained choices, I think, are incredibly important. And it is also the case that we aren't always linear learners in all topics, right? And, you know, particularly social studies and science and things of that nature, the notion that science should always be biology, chemistry, physics, doesn't hold up, right? And so having that ability to control the path, I think is really important for a lot of kids. And so I would love to see, rather than the MCAS, right, or the end of year assessment, as I learn different standards, I can prove mastery on them in a variety of ways, whether that's through a simple test, whether that's through a project, whether that's through a written, you know, paper, whatever it might be, I can show mastery and then have a little dashboard, if you will, right? Showing, yep, you have, you're working on it. You haven't even looked at it yet. It's sort of three indicator lights, right? And give a picture of me as the individual. And by the way, then a college might start to say, okay, Michael's mastered the basic, you know, core set of things, but then God, he went super deep in, you know, Cold War history and implications on whatever it is. And wow, like that's who he is as a unique individual. Whereas Gary, you know, you went super deep in physics or something like that. That's who you are as a unique individual. And I think that should be how our school system evolves, which is, how do we help be the best, every individual be the best unique version of themselves, as opposed to trying to compete to be the best on some very structured linear ladder that breaks apart the moment we get into the real world anyway. And we start to realize, oh, those rankings and things that I thought were so important, no one actually cares in the way that I thought they did, right? The prestige that I thought was so important, you know, maybe it pales in comparison to, you know, are my daughters happy today, right? and things of that nature. And so I think that to me is the shift. It's not standards per se that are an evil, but when they are held so tightly in terms of sequence and assumption around time, that's when they fall apart. And to me, the big shift is moving to a mastery-based learning system where we start to understand what have you mastered and be able to demonstrate and signal and show that mastery.
But that gets right back to Clayton's dichotomy between customization and standardization.
Yeah.
You know, we've got this whole idea, you know, let 1,000 flowers bloom, but we have these massive systems, education systems, that somehow need to move, you know, in Massachusetts, 900,000 and nationally, I don't know, millions and millions of kids through some kind of process so that at the end of it, colleges can do something with them, but more importantly, the economy can do something with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can't have a million kids mastering underwater basket weaving when there are only a few jobs for that particular skill. So yeah. You've got, you know, it gets, you know, it gets to the whole, what's the function of education, but how do we,
on that point, I think, I'm probably a little bit more conventional and conservative on this point than some folks that swim in these waters in terms of the unmitigated choice. But I do think a part of this is we need to do a much better job in schools of connecting kids much earlier to career professionals from a variety of fields so that they can start to understand what are the possibilities out there beyond my immediate social circle and beyond my parents, and what are the skills that are valued, right, in those jobs, so that they can start to make better decisions alongside their teachers, right? Like, teachers are an incredibly important part of this, to not just sort of accept the student's choice, but to guide them actively towards something that will be productive. And that feedback loop, I think, is incredibly important between, you know, the outside of school world. I won't call it the real world because schools are real too, but the outside of school world and schools, I think we need to make that a much more permeable, you know, boundary where there's much more connections actively, so people can develop mentors, a sense of what they could do, a sense of why certain subjects are important and so forth. And I do think, like, you know, there are certain things that we might be rigorous on. Like, I want you to be able to read a passage and draw out inferences on it or be able to evaluate a claim and understand how persuasive it is and make some arguments around it. Things like those sorts of standards, I think, are important, but they leave a lot of room for different curricular paths to demonstrating them, right? And so I those are the conversations I think we don't have enough of, is like, what really is the core that we really want every child to do? I think in math, we'd probably say up to algebra is certainly core. And then I might branch, to be honest with you. I might say, I want algebra, statistics, financial literacy, data visualization. And I'm okay with, you know, the student having some choice of which one of those they want to go deep on, right? I don't think every kid needs to go algebra 2, for example. Some exposure probably to algebra is important so they can make an informed choice, but then they can make a choice in my mind. And, you know, that's sort of the conversation I think we need to have more honestly right now of, yeah, look, there are certain expectations from the public society perspective. Privately education, I suppose you have a lot more autonomy to make those choices. But in the public, where there are other people's dollars at work, yeah, I think it's an important conversation to have honestly. But I think we're way too far on one side of it right now, I guess, is where I land.
The side that we're on, I think, has been developing since 1957. The side that we're on now is everything is STEM.
Yes.
And I think the consensus there, it's not even a consensus, it's almost universal, that education should be plugged into the economy and it should lead to jobs. Before Sputnik, you know, that wasn't by any means the consensus, but now everything is STEM, and there's very little literature, there's very little, you know, sociology, any of that stuff. You know, if you look at undergraduate majors, you know, back in my day, everybody was an English major. Now, nobody's an English major. Everybody's a business major.
Yep.
You know, when I was an undergraduate, we laughed at the business majors, but that's completely changed. And now I think since NDEA, the focus on STEM is just, it's almost universal, to the exclusion of a lot of, you know, a lot of those things like analyzing a paragraph or understanding what the Iranians or anybody else might be thinking and why they do the things they do. You can't solve that. You can't answer that question with mathematics.
I think you're 100% right. And I think we have way over indexed on the STEM stuff. Do I think people need to be literate in those fields? Yeah. But to me, you know, McKinsey hires a disproportionate number of philosophy majors, it turns out, from college. Well, because they know how to think, right? They know how to grapple with questions. People with, you know, working at the fringes of artificial intelligence, I want them to have grappled with the major questions of history and ethics and philosophy and have read the great thinkers in a variety of traditions, right? To grapple with these very real questions that they're going to have of, you know, autonomous driving, like your car has a choice to hit, you know, the one woman over here or the three kids over here. Like, these are very complex questions that are not easily answered. And I want people to have seriously thought about them. And at least my read is that disruption is having another effect, which is it's commoditizing the expertise of the, you know, most extreme experts in science and coding and things of that nature, which is making it easier for all the rest of us to be able to code and do certain things. Now, you know, someone like me is not going to be at the forefront of creating, you know, CRISPR or something like that that leads to a COVID vaccine. But because we can manipulate these blocks in a variety of ways on programs, we can actually do a lot more than we otherwise would be able to, which I think means that the real differentiators for people are going to be in your ability to think like a human. So the humanities, the liberal arts. And I think we've way, particularly in college, but we've way underemphasized those sorts of things. And I actually, you see it in elementary school too, right? Like the amount of time that's spent on social studies and, you know, history in effect is scant. And I think that's a huge mistake for two reasons. One, for all the stuff I just said, but two, because I think the evidence around becoming a good reader is very convincing that broad, coherent knowledge is incredibly important. And that means you don't learn, you know, after you learn phonics and fluency, et cetera, right? The five core skills of reading, then it's all about accumulating knowledge to be able to make sense of what you're reading. And that is necessarily means broad-based and coherent. So, you know, reading across science, social studies, arts, music, you know, like a variety of fields is actually incredibly important to becoming a literate human that can function in society. So that when you read the newspaper and someone says, you know, Iran today feels like, you know, Munich in the 1930s or whatever, you have an ability to understand that reference, evaluate it, think about, is Neville Chamberlain back then really like, you know, this today, and make some set of judgments. And by the way, maybe even call back to the Greeks and you know, similar claims as Don Kagan would have said, the great Yale historian, you know, around a lot of these questions are basically fundamental human nature that you can use to evaluate. That's who I want in these various jobs, evaluating this sort of stuff. Also, so to me, the economy, I think the tightly coupled is broadly a good thing, but I think we've misinterpreted what is valuable and over-indexed on things that creates more uniformity than differentiation, and values created in differentiation in our world. And so that's part of my belief of you know, the sanctity of individuals being able to develop their unique talents.
Well, now that we've settled that, but that really brings out a whole dimension of the use of technology I remember, you know, just back a few minutes ago, the importance of teachers. I can remember comments or statements that teachers made back in fourth grade that, you know, that have been very influential. I had a German teacher in high school who I never learned much German from, but he said one day, "Read widely, son. That's the secret. Read widely." Yeah. Well,
yes. Yeah.
You know, that voice is still in my head. Read widely, son. So we have an unbalanced education system. It's way over on the quantitative side. That suggests that technology can be a way of correcting that imbalance. But again, back on the question of path, it's still, you know, so any kid now has instant access, you know, right in the palm of his hand to all of the Greeks and anybody else you want. But how do we, you know, who is saying to these kids who have got their faces in their phones all day long, who is saying, read widely, son? And if somebody does say, you know, your famous comment, you know, Heidegger said, before you open Nietzsche, you should study Aristotle for 15 years. So who is saying that kind of thing to these kids and, you know, kind of directing them in broader, more maybe humanistic might be the term. Who's saying that?
Yeah, I mean, I think teachers need to play this role, right? First and foremost. But secondly, I'd say this is also the value of connecting intentionally students to experts outside of school as well. Great book, Range, by David Epstein, that shows that the majority of people who become incredibly successful in their fields did not specialize early on. There's some exceptions, like in the field of chess, but you know, he just put out a great newsletter about how even Serena Williams, you know, greatest tennis player ever, right? Her dad made sure that she was playing other sports, that she was doing great in school, that she was doing fashion, that she had all these other interests, and how it contributed to her development, right? And to being able to last as long as she has, because, you know, didn't have this burnout syndrome and other things of that nature. And there are exceptions, but the preponderance of the evidence is that most people actually, you know, you try out a career, it doesn't work out. You learn something about yourself. You try something else. You learn something about yourself, and then you find your thing, right? Todd Rose has his book Dark Horses on this topic as well. And I think if we have these conversations more actively, connect people to real people in the workforce as opposed to avatars in our mind, we'll hear that, oh, actually, you know, the thing that really got me to be this scientist was I read this influential book by, you know, Darwin or Crick and Watson, right? Or whatever it might be. And that's the thing that excited me. And then I read this other thing with all these ethical questions, and that really influenced me in this way and that way, right? Oh my goodness. So that's going to be important as if I'm to become a scientist, right? I don't want anyone listening to this hearing me say that I don't think more scientists are important. I think they are, but I don't think we want to be so one-dimensional about that view of what it is. I do think balance is important. And so it's one of the reasons that I think standards are important, but I don't want them to be coupled to time, as we were talking about earlier.
So kind of a side issue in all of this is the de-emphasis in a lot of colleges on SAT and ACT and those other standardized tests. Harvard's not looking at it now. And a lot of other places.
Yeah, till at least 2026, yeah.
Yeah. Is that a good thing? And till 2026. So does that mean in 2027 they're going to go back to it?
Yeah, it's a huge question. I confess my skepticism a little bit because there's not another system in place that can show or give us confidence around mastery of a variety of things yet. And the evidence, I think, is somewhat convincing that low-income students actually get more penalized when we move at the moment to portfolios and papers because they don't have the advantage of their parents helping support them, write them, and so forth. So I get the motivation, right, to move away from the current testing regime. I don't love tests functioning as a one-time gatekeeper. I prefer, you know, a more multifaceted, decoupled from time sort of view of individuals. But I worry we're moving away from something before we have a better answer in place to really help with this challenge, and that the impact could be more pernicious than we think it might be.
Well, it's ironic because, of course, the original purpose of that back with Conant was to level the playing field so that poor kids...
Right, and allow Jews, right, to get access and so forth, right? And and I think we've somehow... There was an article in Forbes a while back sort of saying... Just assume that the premise assumed that the tests were racist and so forth because they show racial disparities. I think they are far more a mirror on the inadequacies of what's going on in schools and homes than they are in of themselves. Historically, have there been issues with the tests? Absolutely, right? Those have been well documented. But I don't think that's the overriding challenge. I think they're more a mirror or an indicator light, right, of something that we don't like. And we shouldn't like it. We shouldn't accept it. But I don't think we should blame the messenger quite as much as we're doing right now. There's a great piece, by the way, by John McWhorter, who talks about the importance of the canon, if you will. And I'm not one that believes that's the only way to get a lot of these insights, frankly. I've learned a ton from Buddhist traditions and other sources, but he makes a really compelling set of points. And I do think cultural literacy in our country, and again, this gets to the literacy and reading question, you know, you are at an advantage, whether we like it or not, if you've wrestled with certain ideas and texts and so forth. Some of these things I think are important, right, regardless of background, to take seriously.
Well, if you think about cultural literacy, if you think about the, you know, well-documented fact that 9 out of 10 or something like that, Americans can't tell you how many senators we have or name their governor and so forth, and then just move directly from that to January 6th. Cultural literacy looks like not a luxury, but, you know, a matter of survival.
Yeah, actually, let's double down on that just for a moment, because obviously we're recording this the day before the January 6th 1-year commemoration of this horrible events at the Capitol. And I think what you just said is right. Like, if we were to have a serious conversation about what's really core, I think we'd come to an understanding that we are doing a really poor job on civics and basic foundation history of our country and the roots from which that tradition developed to lead to the Constitution and what the Federalist Papers said, and then the system of government. And then certain things have been frozen, right? The number of representatives we have in the House have been frozen for the last century, even as our population has something like tripled, right? And so, we might then be able to ask some better questions of where are the breakdowns occurring and be able to diagnose better different solutions. And is it really about enlarging the Supreme Court, or is it about enlarging actually the House of Representatives so we can restore some connection again? And, you know, I, not to venture an opinion on this here, although I have one, but I think the point is, like, we need to be able to have those conversations, which means that you need to have a certain foundation. And so in my mind, as we thought about what's core, I'm not saying you need to know the exact, you know, date of the Battle of Trenton, right, in 1776, but I do think you should have a certain arc of the history that while this was occurring, the Declaration was already out. The Declaration was based on these ideals. Let's read these papers. And then it didn't work, right, in terms of the Articles of Confederation. And so this was the Constitution that came out of this, and this was what it was trying to rectify, and these were the debates. And this is why gridlock is actually built into the system, right, and so forth. And understand those sorts of currents, I think, would improve our conversations immensely.
How is that going to happen when nobody even knows how many senators there are?
I 100% agree with you. Those basic facts need to be part of that.
How do we get, and that kind of, another question about the role of technology. Technology obviously tremendously increases our ability to communicate, to talk to other people, to access all kinds of information. But it looks like now the effect of that universal access to everything has been to atomize rather than to unite. So you've got all, you know, all these fringe Alex Joneses and all of that. Where is, you know, we're not going to do away with technology. It's not going away. So since we have this sort of universal, there's a Greek term for that I can't remember, this universal mind going on, how can it be managed or whatever so that we can get actual dialogue or, understanding going rather than the complete ridiculous atomization that we actually have?
Yeah. So I don't know the answer to the question. Obviously,
it's you don't know the answer. One, well, forget it then.
But let me give you a couple ideas, and then you can tell me the answer. The first thought is the waves of technology, I think, are interesting in all this. If you went back to the 1800s, the dominant technology of the printing press at that time was such that we couldn't create national papers at scale. And so actually a lot of the dynamics around the Civil War were quite similar to what we see now in terms of lots of atomized micro conversations. There were six different newspapers in the town, all of which represented a different particular viewpoint, and you subscribed to one of them or read one of them, and you had conversations like that. And then the technology changed, interestingly enough, and gave way to these national newspapers and then broadcast national media and some standardization, and the conversation became more uniform through the 1900s. And now we're seeing the opposite again, right, in terms of the technology. So it's interesting, I think, to think through that and puzzle what that might mean in the future and what the next flip might be. The second thing I think that says, though, is the importance of narrative in all of this. And I think about it in two ways. Narrative is how we learn. We learn through stories as humans. That is the oldest way of teaching. And rather than spitting a bunch of facts or having a bunch of, you know, sort of shotgun concepts that you have to get through, weaving together things in a deeper, more cohesive narrative, I think is a powerful part of the learning experience and something we ought to think about. How do we do more compellingly? Because I think if we do that, people will learn more, but it will also be more integrated and less atomistic, perhaps than it is right now. And I'm blanking on his name right now, but the guy who wrote Sapiens does a great job of showing how important central narrative is actually to holding societies together in many ways. You know, what are the myths, the common myths that we all sort of subscribe to, if you will. So I think we need to think about that and wrestle with it. And then the last one is the role of questions, I think, is really important in all this. How do we ask questions that are important and perplexing and spark curiosity for kids in schools to want to understand how many senators there are, to understand why this is going to be important to what they do on a daily basis, to how it connects back to their lived experience in their community? And we often get in these debates around relevance and cultural relevance and so forth. And I think sometimes we fear them because we're thinking too narrowly about what relevance means. And my take is my daughters at age 7 right now, are they find all sorts of questions relevant and fascinating to their lives, right? We don't need to fear, I guess, asking good questions. We just need to be able to ask good questions more intentionally, I think.
Can you give an example of a question that they have raised?
Oh boy, they ask all sorts of ones around, you know, that will be even simple ones, right? Like we're driving along the highway and they've done something on, they got rulers for the holidays and I showed them the metric system off of it, right? Well, why do we have miles then and not kilometers, Dad? Right? Well, that's a fantastic question. And it has math dimensions. It has historical dimensions. It has political dimensions to it. You know, there's a great story, right, from the 1960s about America and Canada both deciding to adopt the metric system. The Canadians all saluted and said, yep, let's do it. And they flipped over a switch. And the Americans said, forget you, government. We're going to stick with our conventional system, right? And why is that? Well, why is that? Well, there's a great origin and set of, you know, facts that bear on that around roots and conception of government and things of that nature, right? That start to get at a lot of these. And, you know, but Dad, it's so logical. Well, you're right. So I think these, like, that's a very simple question that can lead into exploration of a lot of really neat things that are incredibly relevant. And dare I say, in most communities in America, it'd be a pretty interesting jumping off point for that young child.
Napoleon didn't have a navy.
Right. And why was that? Well, yeah.
It's a great question. It's a great question. Well, let's think about, or let's try to think about, where is it going? So, mm-hmm. You know, right now, we know what we've got right now. We've got maybe a third to 40% of the population or the electorate or a chunk of the population that gets its voice heard, who don't believe that there is such a thing as a fact, you know, and that's either... Well, we know what we're talking about, but no sense of fact. One of my favorite quotes from Eliot is the highest achievement of a civilization is the sense of fact. Well, we ain't got that. So narrative, obviously, that's how we think, you know, language and thought. That's how we think. We think in language, and language is narrative. But how do we get to some kind of agreement about what is a fact? You know, were they peaceful tourists or were they violent insurrectionists?
Right, right. I don't know that I know the answer, but I also think if we can take it out of sometimes the very narrow dichotomy that we paint, right, where there's two sides going at each other and create more of the complexity, I think we give people more room to say, this is what we agree on. right? And this is what, you know, do we think this is acceptable behavior, right? Strip it of why they did it for a moment. And some of those things, I think, are important to be able to, you know, rather than do the, yeah, but they did X, right? I think if we can create more complex pictures sometimes, and Adam Grant's book, Think Again, I think does a good job of sort of painting some of this, of how you get people to rethink or see fuller pictures by introducing, you know, less assuredness of what actually happened, right? And creating more room for variability in the story and contradiction and anomaly and so forth. I think that is part of it, you know, getting away from the you're with us or against us mentality in this and starting at some first principles of what do we agree upon? And then move into the, okay, so we disagree about X, right? A much smaller slice of the larger fraught question. What would it take to validate that? And then that's the question, right? And then let's think about the evidence that we'd have to marshal and have a conversation around that. I think that's part of this. And interrogate, you know, it's this interesting contradiction. Knowledge and facts are incredibly important to establishing literacy. And we want to also very clearly show that, yeah, sometimes our understandings do change, right? And so weaving it together in an integrated education process, I think, would help all of us think more critically about these things.
So the place where any of this is likely to occur is in schools, because,
yes.
You know, schools from the age of, you know, whatever, 5 to 16, every single kid in the country is required by law to be in school. So. And, you know, Aristotle, you know, said education is the most important function of government because it shapes the character of the citizen. Mm-hmm. So as well as, he didn't say this, but as well as the future employee of Raytheon.
Sure.
your neighbor up there. So we know that technology is, it's in school, you know, we're calling it blended learning. We have this tremendously powerful information communication mechanism at our command. Aristotle would have, actually, I don't know, he might have been aghast at this, but anyhow, what's the future of blended learning? What's it going to be? And is it going to lead towards more atomization, or is it somehow going to lead to cohesion? You know, societal cohesion. What do you see the next, you know, the next 5 minutes or 5 years?
Yeah, I don't know the answer. My hope is that we do it in the service of interesting questions that create more far-reaching interdisciplinary projects that then in turn fuel the need to build more knowledge and pull that, you know, from the technology and create that virtuous cycle, and that we stop seeing reading as its own subject that's decoupled from everything else and start realizing that these things are all connected. And if we can do that and get out of our way on some of this, I think the opportunities are significant. You know, I'm working on a new book right now, as you know, that'll be out in July, From Reopen to Reinvent. And purposely, technology only appears in chapter 6 of the book. You know, the book's a lot around mastery-based learning, around the centrality of projects, around new models of teaching, trying to get people to reconceptualize a lot of the assumptions that we have embedded in schooling today, to, I think, our detriment to being able to get out of this atomistic view. You know, there's a guy, Peter Green, used to be a teacher. He writes a column, loves to rip on mastery-based learning or competency-based learning because he says it will overly atomize things. And I was trying to address his comments and, you know, seriously in the text. And there's one way to go right at it. And then there's another way to say, you know, you could be right. But I also think our current system isn't nailing this either. So I don't know that your concern is an important one, but I don't know that it's integrated or has to be coupled, right, to the thing that you're pushing back on. And that's where, that gets to your point, right? Of a lot of people have gotten really angry at certain standards and testing and so forth. And my take is like, well, there've been some good sides of those things. And there's clearly been places where they've been executed in ways that have really been bad and unfortunate. So how do we like decouple the conversation and makes it and make it a little more complex so we can get to this more integrative, wholesome or full picture learning, I guess, is what I might say.
You have a lot of work to do to make all this happen.
We all do, don't we? Don't we? We all have a lot of work. One of the things that I concluded as I've written my way through the book, because you never have the conclusion up front, is ironically, I think we're going to have a lot smaller learning communities within schools. And these trends of micro schools and so forth, I think are incredibly positive, ironically, because they create more room for the innovation and to reinvent and then attract people into them. And I think, that district superintendent who's super frustrated, they can't get through the change because this faction wants this and that faction wants this. Start a small little school within a school. Take a step forward. Start another school within a school. Take another step forward, right? Success will get more people excited and create more common understandings of what you're trying to do if what you're trying to do is really march us toward progress, right, along these dimensions. And so I think the first half of the book is some broad sweeping statements around what I think schooling ought to look like. And it's more prescriptive perhaps than past things I've written. And then the second half of the book is, and here are the baby steps that maybe we can take to get there.
Well, the idea of micro schools or micro learning communities in this technological context where anybody has access to everything at his fingertips, it means that a small micro school does not have to depend on the teachers who happen to be there. You want to know about Aristotle, just Google Aristotle in there.
Yeah, that's right.
You got it. So you can have a small community which has access to everything. So it's an interesting moment. That wasn't the case, a couple of decades ago.
Yep. Well, and this is the other piece of it, right? To your point, which is the biggest disruptive innovation in education historically has been the printed textbook or the printed book, going back to Gutenberg, right? And it increased access to knowledge in ways that we probably still understate. The same is ultimately going to be true out of this revolution. It'll be uneven. It's going to be messy, but it's, in my mind, it's clearly going in that direction in the long run. And that's the perhaps the most promising trend of all in all this, which is, the long run, we're all dead, I suppose, anyway. I do think there's that positive sense of progress ultimately that's going to increase access and freedom.
I do want to take issue with you, though, about in the long run, we're all dead anyway. We're still talking about Aristotle, and he's been dead for 2,500 years. But
I will second you there. I will second you there. Ideas have important lasting implications.
Incredible. Yeah. Michael, thank you. This has been really, really interesting. And I think we got to a very interesting conclusion there. So we will thank you. I really have enjoyed this and learned a lot. I'll be looking forward to that book. What's your title?
Reopen to reinvent. Yeah.
Good idea. And
But thank you, by the way. I've learned a ton in this conversation as well. It's great when you just have these dialogues to develop your own thinking, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, yes. That's what Socrates was. It's all about dialogue. So thank you. We will process this and I'll look. Do you have any pieces of the book that you've published elsewhere?
Yeah, good question. Some stuff is on, like, little snippets are on that Substack newsletter that I send out, which were ways for me to sort of develop some of the ideas, like about the purpose of schooling, for example, that then becomes its own chapter in the book. So there's little snippets that are out there already. Yeah,
I'll look for it. So thank you.
Yeah, amazing. Well, this has been a heck of a lot of fun. I really appreciate your questions and the inquiry. So thank you.
Thank you. Maybe, as things change in another 10 minutes, we may have to do this all over again.
Yeah. Well, if it renders us moot, then that's a good thing.
Yeah. So. Thank you very much, Michael.
Hey, thanks, guys. Yeah, okay. Be well.
We would like to thank Michael Horn for joining us this month for the JFYNet podcast. You can find more information about Michael and his publications on his website, michaelbhorn.com. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, which also features a wealth of commentary, dialogue, and free scholastic resources, including this monthly podcast, to support all educational communities. Thank you for joining us. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham.